Welcome back to the deep dive. Today we are we're standing on the edge of a pretty massive cliff in our study of economics.
That's a good way to put it.
A cliff. Yeah, because we've spent a lot of time in this, you know, this comfortable safe harbor of descriptive statistics. You know the drill. You have a spreadsheet, you have the data right in front of you, and you just describe it. You calculate an average, you find the median, you make a nice chart. It's all very tangible.
It is. It absolutely is.
Yeah.
Descriptive statistics is effectively accounting. You're summarizing facts that you already possess.
Right.
There's no ambiguity because the numbers are just, they're staring you in the face.
But today, we jump off that cliff. We are moving into the wild frontier of statistical inference.
Yes.
And this is where the game just changes completely. We're no longer just talking about the data we have. We're trying to say something intelligent about data we don't have.
That is the pivotal shift. I mean, this is the moment where economics becomes a science of prediction and estimation rather than just observation.
Yeah.
And so the core mission for this deep dive is to understand the mechanics of that leap. Specifically, how do we use a small, manageable handful of numbers?
Our sample mean.
Our sample mean, which we usually call X bar, to make a rigorous mathematical guess about the true population mean, the one we call mu.
And guess sounds so casual, but we're talking about a very specific kind of guessing.
Oh, very specific.
The big idea we need to wrap our heads around, and I know this trips up a lot of first-year students, is that the sample mean isn't just a number. It's not, you know, a static fact like your height or weight. It is a realization of a random variable.
Exactly. If there's one concept, just one, to lock into your mind right now, it is that one. You have to stop viewing the sample mean as a fixed point and start viewing it as a creature that moves.
A creature that moves.
It has behavior. It has a personality almost.
I love that. It has a personality. So, okay. So we're going to break down the psychology of this random variable. We're going to look at the definitions, the properties, things like unbiasedness and efficiency. And we're going to walk through the, I guess, the magic of the central limit theorem. And finally, we're going to test all of this theory against some hard reality.
Right, with some actual data.
Using coin tosses and actual data from the 1880 U.S. Census.
It is a full itinerary.
Yeah.
But before we get to the complex stuff, we have to, you know, we have to agree on our terms.
Lay the groundwork.
We need to go back to the bedrock. We need to talk about what we mean by an experiment in a random variable.
Right. Because in normal conversation, an experiment implies, like, white lab coats, bubbling test tubes, maybe a control group of mice or something.
Yeah, something very formal.
But in statistics, the bar is a lot lower, isn't it?
Much lower.
Yeah.
In this context, an experiment is simply any operation where you don't know the outcome for certain until you actually do it.
Okay.
Tossing a coin is an experiment. Rolling a die is an experiment. Even something as mundane as picking a name out of a hat or calling a random phone number to ask for someone's income. Those are all experiments.
So it's basically any action that generates data where the result isn't predestined.
Exactly.
And that leads us to the random variable. I feel like this is where the notation starts to get a little heavy for people, you know, listening without a whiteboard.
Mm-hmm.
We see big X and little x.
It is a crucial distinction, but it is, I think, easy to grasp if you think about it chronologically.
Mm.
The uppercase X represents the random variable before you run the experiment.
Okay.
It is the concept. It is the question mark. It represents all the potential outcomes.
Okay, so uppercase X is me standing there holding the coin, getting ready to flip. The potential exists for heads or tails, but nothing has actually happened yet.
Precisely. It is the process itself. Now, lowercase x is what happens after the coin lands.
The result.
It is the specific realized value. It's the answer. So uppercase X is the variable. Lowercase x is the data point you write down in your notebook.
That makes the notation much less scary. Big letter equals the idea. Small letter equals the number.
Right.
Let's make this concrete with the simplest experiment in the book, the coin toss.
Mm-mm.
Or if we want to be fancy, the Bernoulli distribution.
The Bernoulli is the building block of almost everything in this field. So let's set up the variables. We map the outcome heads to the value 1 and tails to the value 0.
Okay.
If it is a fair coin, the probability for each of those outcomes is 0.5.
Simple enough. But here is where the language gets tricky. We talk about the population mean, or mu, for a coin toss. But mu is supposed to be the expected value.
Yes.
And if I flip a coin, I expect a 0 or a 1. I don't. I don't expect a 0.5.
That is such a common point of confusion. The term expected value is a bit of a misnomer in plain English.
It seems like it.
It doesn't mean the number we think will happen next. It means the probability-weighted average of all possible values over the long run. It's like the center of gravity for the distribution.
Okay, the center of gravity. So mechanically, how do we find that center of gravity?
You take every possible outcome, you multiply it by the probability of that outcome happening, and then you just add them all up.
Okay, let's do that mental math. We have two outcomes. Outcome one is zero for tails.
Right.
The probability is 0.5. So zero times 0.5 is zero.
Easy enough.
Outcome two is one for heads. Probability is also 0.5. So one times 0.5 is 0.5.
Okay, so add them together. Zero plus 0.5. Your population, mean your mu, is 0.5.
Which, again, is a number that will literally never appear on the coin.
Never.
The mean represents the balance point, not necessarily an actual outcome.
And just to drive this home, let's say it's an unfair coin. Let's say the probability of heads is 0.6.
So it's weighted.
Right. Now, what's the mean? It would be zero times your 0.4 for tails plus one times 0.6 for heads.
So 0 plus 0.6, the mean is now 0.6.
Exactly. The balance point shifts towards the more likely outcome.
To really cement this, let's try a harder one. Let's call this mental check number one for everyone listening.
Yep.
Imagine a financial investment or maybe a very weird, unfair coin. Let's say you have a random variable, X. There is an 80% chance you get the number 100.
Okay, so 0.8 probability.
And there is a 20% chance you get the number 600.
Okay, so a small chance of a big payoff.
Right. So most of the time I get 100, sometimes I get lucky and hit 600. I want to calculate the mean of this thing.
Walk me through it step by step.
All right. Step one, weight the first outcome. The value is 100. The probability is 0.8. So 100 times 0.8 gives me 80.
Good.
Step two, weight the second outcome. The value is 600. The probability is 0.2. So 600 times 0.2 is, that's 120.
Correct. And the final step.
Add them up. 80 plus 120 equals 200. So the mean is 200.
There you go. The expected value is 200. And notice, again, you will never, ever see the number 200 appear in your account.
Yep.
You'll only see 100 or 600. But the long run average, if you played this game a million times, your average winnings would be 200.
Okay. So the mean tells us where the center is. But, you know, knowing the center isn't enough.
Not at all.
If I tell you the average temperature is 70 degrees, that could mean it's a nice, pleasant day, or it could mean it fluctuates between 140 degrees and zero.
Right. Averages can hide a lot of volatility.
We need to measure the spread. We need the variance.
Variance is the measure of risk, or, you know, uncertainty. Technically, it is the expected value of the squared deviation from the mean.
Okay. Squared deviation from the mean. That sounds like a lot of syllables. Let's decode the machinery inside that phrase.
Let's do it.
Why are we squaring things? What's the point of the square?
We square the difference because we care about the distance from the center, not the direction.
Okay.
If we just added up the differences, the negatives, the values below the mean, would cancel out the positives,
yeah.
The values above the mean.
And we'd just get zero, which isn't helpful.
We get zero, which tells us nothing. Squaring makes everything positive. It forces the math to acknowledge the spread, no matter what side of the mean it's on.
Okay, let's go back to our fair coin to see this in action. We found the mean was 0.5.
Yep.
Let's say we flip a tails, which is a zero.
Right, so step one, find the deviation. How far is zero from the mean of 0.5?
It's negative 0.5 away.
It is negative 0.5 away. Step two, square that distance. Negative 0.5 times negative 0.5 gives us positive 0.25.
So the squared distance for tails is 0.25.
Step three, weight it by its probability. Tails happens half the time, right?
Right, 0.5.
So 0.25 times 0.5 equals 0.125.
Okay, hold that number in your head, 0.125. Now we do the heads side.
Mm-hmm.
The value is 1. The mean is 0.5, so the distance is positive 0.5.
Square it, you get 0.25 again, multiply by the probability of 0.5. and you get another 0.125.
So we have two chunks of 0.125. We add them up and we get 0.25. The variance of a fair coin toss is 0.25.
You have just calculated a population variance, sigma squared.
Mm-hmm.
Now, variance is great, but the units are weird.
Right.
If we were talking about dollars, the variance would be in square dollars, which doesn't make any intuitive sense.
What even is a square dollar?
Exactly. That is why we usually take the square root to get the standard deviation, the one we call sigma.
Which brings us back to the original units. Dollars, not square dollars. So the square root of 125 is 0.5.
So for a fair coin, the mean is 0.5 and the standard deviation is 0.5.
It is elegant in its simplicity.
It is. But now we have to scale this up. We are leaving the world of the single coin toss and entering the world of the random sample.
This is the real transition to inference.
Now, this is it. We are moving from one to many.
We aren't just flipping one coin. We are flipping, say, no coins or surveying nuller people.
Right. A sample is a subset of size no-dol drawn from the population. We denote the values we get as little 6 by $200 all the way to 6 on.
Okay.
But, and this connects back to our earlier point, before we draw them, we view them as random variables. Big XD nuller ways, big 60 nullers, and so on.
And this leads us to the star of today's show, the sample mean. We calculate it by adding up all our observations and dividing by dollar. We've all done that since grade school. But you said earlier we need to treat the sample mean as a random variable itself.
This is the crucial concept. This is the idea that differentiates a statistician from, say, a calculator.
Okay, explain.
Imagine I take a random sample of 10 people and I calculate their average income. I get a number.
Right.
Now, you take a totally different random sample of 10 people and you calculate their average income. Are you going to get the same number as me?
Almost certainly not.
Almost certainly not. If we do this 1,000 times, we will get 1,000 different averages.
Mm.
Because the input, the sample, is random. The output, the sample mean, is also random. The sample mean fluctuates. It has its own distribution.
That's a wild thought. We usually think of the average as the stable thing, the summary, but you're saying the average itself is jittery.
It is.
It bounces around depending on who got picked for the sample.
It is jittery, but it isn't chaotic. It follows rules. And to understand those rules, we make three standard assumptions about the population we are drawing from.
The simple random sample assumptions.
Right. We just call them A, B, and C.
Let's run through them. Assumption A.
Common mean. We assume every observation we draw comes from a population that is centered at the same mu. We aren't, you know, mixing data from two totally different worlds.
Okay, that makes sense. Assumption B.
Common variance. Every observation has the same underlying volatility, the same sigma squared.
Your assumption C. This one feels like the most important one.
It's critical. Independence. This means the value of the first person we pick, sex dollars, one dollars, tells us absolutely nothing about the value of the second person, X to dollars.
So if I pick you for my survey, it doesn't change the probability of my picking your neighbor next.
Exactly. Each draw is a fresh start.
So if we have a sample that follows these rules, same mean, same spread, and everyone is independent, we can start to say some very powerful things about how that jittery sample mean behaves.
We can. We can describe the properties of the sample mean. There are really two main properties we care about. Its center and its spread.
Okay, let's start at the center. If I take 1,000 different samples and find the average of all those thousands of averages, where do I end up?
You end up exactly at the truth.
Really?
Mathematically, the expected value of the sample mean is the population mean, so 8 bar mu's. And this property has a name. It's called unbiasedness.
I like the target practice analogy here. If an estimator is unbiased, it means your sights are aligned correctly.
This is a perfect analogy.
You might miss a little left on one shot, a little right on the next, but you aren't systematically aiming at the wrong tree. Your shots are centered on the bullseye.
Exactly. You are centered on the bullseye. But hitting the bullseye on average isn't enough, right?
No.
You want your shots to be tightly grouped. You don't want one shot in the dirt and one shot way over the mountain, even if their average somehow is the bullseye.
Right, that's not very helpful. That brings us to the spread or the variance of the sample mean. And this is where the formula gets really, really interesting.
The formula for the variance of the sample mean is sigma squared divided by n, sigma 2 axis.
Okay, let's just pause on that for a second.
We should. Take a moment to visualize that fraction.
Mm.
The numerator is sigma squared. That's the wild, noisy variance of the individual people in the population.
The chaos.
The chaos, right.
Right.
But the denominator is not your sample size.
That denominator is doing all the heavy lifting.
It is.
We are dividing the chaos by the sample size. So the bigger our sample, the bigger n gets, the smaller the variance of our average becomes.
It is the crushing power of aggregation.
Mm-hmm.
If you pick one person, they could be an extreme outlier.
Yeah.
If you average 1,000 people, it is extremely difficult for that average to be an outlier.
Because they cancel out.
The outliers on the high side get canceled out by the outliers on the low side. The average stays tight to the center.
This relationship leads to the standard deviation of a mean, which is just the square root of that variance. So sigma divided by the square root of n, sigma square in n.
Yes.
And this contains a very practical and maybe painful lesson for anyone trying to design a study on a budget. We call it the square root rule.
It is a harsh rule for economists and researchers everywhere. Look at the math. The n is inside a square root.
Yeah.
If you want to cut your error in half, meaning you want to make your estimate twice as precise, you cannot just double your sample size.
Why not?
Because the square root of 2 is only 1.41. that doesn't get you there. To cut the error by a factor of 2, you need to increase your sample size by a factor of 4, because the square root of 4 is 2.
So that implies a massive cost. If I'm paying for a survey and my boss says, this isn't precise enough, double the precision, I have to go back and say, okay, give me 4 times the budget.
Correct. Information is expensive and precision has diminishing returns.
This is why you see so many political polls stop at around, what, 1,000 or 1,500 people?
Exactly. To get significantly better than that, you'd need to survey 4,000 or 5,000 people. And the cost usually isn't worth that tiny extra gain in precision.
Let's do another mental check to lock this in. Let's call it exercise 2.
Right.
Suppose we are sampling from a population. The individual variance, sigma squared, is huge. Let's say it's 400.
Okay, very spread out population.
We take a sample of size n equals 25. What is the variance of our sample mean?
Okay, so just visualize the fraction again. The numerator is 400. That's the population variance. The denominator is 25, the sample size. So we have 400 divided by 25.
Which is 16.
16. Look at that. We went from a variance of 400 for a single person down to a variance of 16 for the average of 25 people.
That is a massive reduction in uncertainty.
It really shows you why we value the mean so much. It filters out so much of the noise.
But wait, it gets even better. Or maybe stranger. We've established that the mean is unbiased and that its variance shrinks. But what about the shape of its distribution? This is where we encounter what you call the magic trick of statistics.
I wouldn't call it a trick, but it is certainly a remarkable result.
The central limit theorem, or CLT?
Yeah, the CLT. It states something that is deeply counterintuitive. It says that no matter what crazy shape your original population has.
It can be anything.
Anything. It could be flat, skewed, binary, jagged.
Yeah.
If you take a large enough sample size, the distribution of the sample mean will look like a perfect, smooth, bell-shaped, normal curve.
That is hard to believe. You're saying I can start with data that looks like a goalpost, just zeros and ones like our coin toss?
Yep.
And if I average enough of them together, I get a perfect bell curve.
Yes. The binary nature just disappears. The jagged edges smooth out. As n gets large, the sample mean, it starts to distribute normally.
And why is that so important?
Because it allows us to use all the standard tools of the normal distribution, like z-scores and p-values and confidence intervals, even when the underlying data is definitely not normal. It's a key that unlocks a huge part of statistical inference.
We don't just have to take your word for it, though. We have a simulation that proves it.
We do.
Let's walk through the coin toss simulation that's mentioned in the notes. We have a population that is just zeros and ones.
Okay, so the mean is 0.5, standard deviation is 0.5. Very not normal.
And we draw 400 different samples. Each sample has 30 coin tosses, so n equals 30.
So think about what that means. In each of those 400 trials, you flip 30 coins and calculate the average. Sometimes you get 0.4, sometimes 0.6, sometimes 0.53. You get 400 of these little averages.
Right. And when we average those 400 sample means, what was the result?
The result was 0.499.
Which is frighteningly close to the true population mean of 0.5.
It is. And the standard deviation of those 400 means was 0.086.
Let's check the theory. Theory says it should be sigma over the square root of n.
Right. So that would be 0.5 divided by the square root of 30. If you plug that into a calculator, you get about 0.09.
So 0.09 from the theory, 0.086 from the simulation. That's almost perfect.
It's spot on. And visually, this is the kicker. If you plotted those 400 averages on a graph, on a histogram,
you wouldn't see two spikes at 0 and 1.
You would not. You would see a mound, a beautiful bell curve, centered perfectly at 0.5. The coinness of the data just vanished and was replaced by normalness.
Okay, that's a simulation. Simulations are clean. The real world is messy. I want to talk about the 1880 U.S. Census case study. This is one of my favorite parts of the material because it deals with actual messy human behavior.
This is a classic data set. It's wonderful because we have the data for all 50,169,452 people living in the U.S. in 1880.
So we have the entire population.
We have the entire census, which means we know the truth. We know the parameters. Mm-hmm. The true mean age, Boo, was 24.13 years.
Wow, 24 years old. It was a young country.
A very young country. And the true standard deviation, sigma, was 18.61 years, a huge spread.
But describe the shape of that population age distribution. Was it a nice bell curve?
Well, it was ugly. First of all, it's not a bell curve because you can't be negative years old.
Mm-hmm.
And the probability of death increases with age. So it's naturally a downward slope.
It's skewed.
It's very skewed.
Yeah.
But the really fascinating part is the human error. Back in 1880, if you asked someone their age, they often just estimated, hey, I'm about 30, I'm about 40.
Right, they rounded.
They rounded. So if you look at the chart of the data, there are massive spikes at age 25, 30, 35, 40. This is called age heaping.
So the data is jagged and flawed and just weird.
It's a nightmare distribution. Not normal, skewed, and full of errors. And the experiment was to draw 100 different samples from this mess, each with the size of just n equals 25.
Only 25 people.
Only 25. Think about that. We're trying to estimate the average age of 50 million people by looking at just 25 people at a time.
That seems impossible.
Well, if you look at just one of those samples, the estimate is terrible. It's really noisy. One sample had a mean age of 27.84.
That's almost 4 years off the true mean of 24.13. That's a huge error.
That's the jitter we talked about. Any single sample can be misleading.
Right.
But look what happens when we look at the aggregation of all 100 samples. The average of those 100 sample means was 23.78.
Wow. That is incredibly close to the truth of 24.13.
Incredibly close. And the standard deviation of those 100 means, it was 3.76.
Okay, let's check the math on that. Theory says it should be sigma divided by the square root of n.
Mm-hmm. The population deviation, sigma, was 18.61. The sample size n was 25. The square root of 25 is 5.
Right.
So 18.61 divided by 5 is 3.72.
And our experiment gave us 3.76. It works.
That's incredible.
It is. Even with a jagged, lying, skewed population of 50 million people, the theory held up perfectly. The sample means distributed normally and tightly around the truth.
That really is the power of the central limit theorem. It just cuts through all the noise and the age heaping and gets you to the signal.
It does. So now we need to formalize this a bit. We've been using words like good estimate. In economics, we have very specific criteria for what makes an estimator good.
Right.
We've touched on them, but let's define them clearly for the notes.
Okay, the hierarchy of definitions. Let's start at the top. First, the parameter.
That is the fixed truth, the mu. In the census example, it's 24.13. It is the number God knows, but we as researchers usually don't.
Okay. Second, the estimator.
That is the recipe, the random variable, the big X bar. It is the method you plan to use to make your guess. And third, the estimate.
That is the specific number you cooked up from your sample, the 27.84, the realization of the random variable.
Parameter, estimator, estimate. So how do we judge an estimator? You said there are three gold standards.
Right. First, unbiasedness. We already covered this. The expected value of the estimator equals the parameter, E bar X.
Yeah.
There's no systematic error.
Okay.
Second, efficiency. This is about minimum variance. If I have two different unbiased estimators, say the sample mean and the sample median, both of which can be unbiased, I want the one that is tighter.
The one with less spread.
The one with less spread. And it turns out that under our standard assumptions, the sample mean is the most efficient unbiased estimator.
Yeah.
It squeezes the most information possible out of the data.
And the third one is consistency. This one involves looking at the horizon.
Yeah, exactly. Consistency asks the question, if I keep adding data, if my sample size grows, do I eventually arrive at the truth?
Does my estimate converge to the parameter?
Precisely. As n goes to infinity, does the estimate lock onto the parameter? And for the sample mean, we know the variance is sigma squared over n. As n gets huge, that fraction goes to zero.
The spread collapses.
The distribution collapses onto the single point. No. So yes, the sample mean is a consistent estimator.
Unbiased, efficient. Consistent. It's the triple crown for an estimator. But, and there is always a but in economics,
there
is a practical snag, a huge one. We have been writing formulas with sigma, the population standard deviation.
Yeah.
But if I'm researching a new phenomenon, I don't know the population mean, so I definitely don't know the population variance or standard deviation.
That is the catch-22 of applied statistics.
Yeah.
It's a real problem. To know how accurate your estimate is, you need to know the variance of the population. But if you knew the variance of the population, you'd probably already know the mean, and you wouldn't need to be doing the sample in the first place.
So you're stuck in a loop.
You're stuck. So how do we escape the trap?
How do we do it?
We cheat slightly. We substitute. We replace the unknown population variance, sigma squared, with the sample variance, which we call six squared. We use the data we do have to estimate the spread of the population.
Okay, that makes sense. But the formula for sample variance, S squared, is slightly different from what you might expect. We divide by n minus 1 instead of just n. Why do we subtract 1 from the denominator?
It's a subtle but very important correction for bias. Think of it this way. To calculate the sample variance, we have to compare the data points to the sample mean.
Right.
Right, because we don't know the true mean.
Exactly. But the sample mean is specifically positioned to be in the dead center of that specific sample. It is, by definition, too close to the data in your sample. This makes the spread look a little bit smaller than it actually is.
Ah, I see. It's an optimistic measure of spread.
It is. It's slightly biased downwards. Yeah. Dividing by n minus 1 instead of n makes the final result a little bit bigger. It inflates the variance just enough to correct for that bias. It's a mathematical tweak to make our estimate unbiased.
That is a great explanation. We use up one piece of information, or one degree of freedom, to find the mean, so we have to pay for it in the denominator.
That's the formal way of saying it, yes.
So when we swap this new estimated standard deviation S into our formula for the spread of the mean, we get a new metric. We have to stop calling it the standard deviation of the mean.
Right.
We start calling it the standard error.
This is a massive terminology alert for every student. It's one of the most common points of confusion.
Standard deviation versus standard error.
Standard error, which we write as SE, generally means the estimated standard deviation of an estimator. The formula changes from sigma over root n to S over root n.
So they measure the same concept, which is precision.
Yes. Conceptually, they are the same thing.
Right.
But standard deviation implies you know the truth, you know sigma. Standard error implies you are estimating that truth from the data you have.
So if you are reading an academic paper and you see SE equals 0.4, that's the author saying, look, I don't know the true sigma, but based on my sample, this is my best guess for how much my average typically fluctuates.
Correct. And that standard error is what allows us to build confidence intervals and do hypothesis testing, which are, you know, topics for another day, but they all build on this foundation.
Okay, before we wrap up, we need to cover a couple of advanced nuances from the last part of the notes.
Let's do it.
We talked about assumption C independence. Everyone is drawn randomly. But what if our sample is bad? What if it isn't representative of the population?
That is where the math breaks down. The whole system we've built relies on that random sample. The classic example is the Golf Digest survey.
Right.
If you try to estimate the average American income by only surveying subscribers to a golf magazine, you are going to get a horribly biased result. They are wealthier and older than the average person.
So independence is violated because you are selecting from a specific non-random cluster of people?
Exactly. Your sample doesn't look like the population. Can we fix it? Or do we just have to throw the data away?
I'm guessing we can sometimes fix it.
Sometimes you can if you have enough information. You can use a weighted mean.
A weighted mean? How does that work?
If you know that, say, rich people are overrepresented in your sample, maybe they're 80% of your sample, but only 10% of the real world, you can assign them a smaller weight.
So you downweight them.
You downweight the overrepresented groups and you upweight the underrepresented ones to make your sample demographics match the population demographics. The formula becomes the sum, the weighted observations, divided by the sum of the weights.
It's like manually rebalancing the scales of justice for your data.
Very good way to put it.
Okay, one last technical detail, and this is about simulations. We talked about the computer flipping coins. How does a computer, which is, you know, a logic machine, a deterministic machine, generate random numbers?
That's a great question. And technically it doesn't. It generates pseudo-random numbers.
Pseudo-random, so fake random.
Fake random. It uses a very complex algorithm to churn out a sequence of numbers that satisfy all the statistical tests for randomness. They look random. They act random for all practical purposes. Mm-hmm. But they are actually determined by a starting value called a seed.
A seed, like planting a tree.
Exactly like that. If you set the seed to, say, 101 and run your simulation, you will get a sequence. Heads, heads, tails, heads.
Okay.
If I go to my computer, set the very same seed to 101 and run the exact same code, I will get heads, heads, tails, heads. The same sequence.
So it's repeatable.
It's perfectly repeatable.
Sure.
And this reproducibility is vital for science. It allows me to check your work. If it were truly physically random, I could never replicate your specific results.
So randomness in the service of science needs to be repeatable. Yeah. That's a bit of a paradox, but a useful one.
A very useful one.
Let's bring this all home. We have covered a huge amount of ground today. We move from the individual random variable X to the sample mean X bar. Hmm. We saw how the mean is unbiased, efficient, and consistent.
The triple crown.
We watched the central limit theorem turn ugly, messy data into a beautiful, predictable bell curve. And we learned the crucial difference between a standard deviation and a standard error.
If you are a student and you're staring at a data set right now, here is your workflow, your four steps.
Okay.
One, collect your sample, your little X's.
Yep.
Two, calculate the average, X bar. This is your best guess for the truth.
That's my estimate.
That's your estimate. Three, calculate the sample standard deviation, S. This tells you how spread out the data in your sample is.
Individual noise.
And four, calculate the standard error, S, divided by the square root of N. This tells you the spread of your guess. How precise is your estimate? If that standard error is small, you can be confident that your X bar is close to the true mu.
Ideally, you want that standard error to be tiny. You want to be able to say, I know the average age is 24 plus or minus a few weeks, not plus or minus 10 years.
That is the goal. That's what we're all trying to do. The sample mean is such a powerful tool. It allows us to know the truth about a massive population, 50 million people, using only a small, tiny sliver of data.
I want to leave you, our listener, with a final provocative thought to mull over. We spent a lot of time today celebrating the central limit theorem. We called it magic because it forces averages into this nice, smooth, normal curve.
Mm-hmm.
But think back to the 1880 census. The real population had those spikes at age 25, 30, 35 because people were rounding their ages. It was jagged. It was flawed. It was human.
Right.
When we rely on the central limit theorem, we smooth all of that out. We get a perfect bell curve. My question is, are we losing something important? By focusing so much on the average, are we stripping away the jagged, messy, interesting nuances that make the data what it is?
That is a profound question for any social scientist. In our quest for generalizability and statistical significance, we often sand down the rough edges of reality.
We lose the texture.
We gain precision about the center, but we might lose the texture of the whole distribution.
Something to think about the next time you see a smooth curve in a textbook. Remember the jagged reality that might be hiding underneath? Thanks for taking this deep dive with us. Go run some numbers.